بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله محمد.
Last night we discussed the principle that a given action that is actualized right now, it's a product of an infinite series of parameters since pre-eternity, but all those parameters have varying influences on that action's coming into being. The closer it is to the action, the more the influence. That we spoke about in some detail last night. Based on this principle, when it comes to nurturing children, Islam, based on this principle, in different phases of the child's life, has assigned certain protocols which maximize the best form of nurturing that is feasible for the physical and spiritual well-being of the child. Last night we went and we spoke about those parameters in the preconception phase. Tonight we'll speak about the conception and post-conception phases, inshallah. One important issue was that even at the time of conception, fertilization, here we see Islam, when the man and woman want to become intimate and commit the action, which we spoke about, I don't want to keep on repeating certain words just in case there are some small children here. When they want to commit and execute the action, Islam has given incredibly a whole list of things to be beware of. And I want to go through some of them. But before I do, there are two or three points that you have to bear in mind. These are potential consequences that may arise if you behave in certain ways at the time of the action. It's not that if you commit X action at the time that you want to, when the man and woman wants to become intimate, when you think in a certain way or do it in a certain way, it doesn't mean it will 100% most definitively lead to that consequence. It's only speaking in potential terms. Why is it speaking in potential terms? Because there are 1,001 different parameters. We don't know how those parameters blend together. So it's not that the effect is a definite. That's one point. The second point, these consequences are negative, which I want to mention, mostly. And when these negative consequences arise for the offspring as a result of the actions of the parents, Ayatollah Jawadi only has stressed this. Don't think that the negative consequence that the child has, the consequence itself, don't think it is a punishment for the parents. It's not a punishment for the parents. It's a cause and effect relationship. The parents did something, it led to this disability, be it a physical or a spiritual disability for the child. Most of these are spiritual disabilities, but in medicine, if the mother and father, for example, they smoke, they drink, it may lead to a congenital illness in the child. That congenital illness of the child isn't meant to be a punishment for the parents. The parents are punished because of the action they did. The child isn't a punishment for the parents. That's one point. Is it fair that the child has been born with this congenital illness? Of course it's not. But who are you attributing the unfairness to? Don't attribute it to Allah. Attribute it to the actions of the parents. They drank, they smoked, or they took certain medication that they shouldn't have. It led to this physical disability. Now, this in medicine is not difficult for us to understand in physical terms, but the same applies in spiritual terms. But for physical, in physical terms, we all go to the doctor, we all see the midwife every week, every month when the wife is pregnant. And we all take folic acid supplements and other supplements. We make sure we don't drink or we don't smoke, although we don't drink anyway, but we don't smoke and other things. We take care of all the physical aspects, but we don't take care of the spiritual elements in child nurturing. And since here the committee wanted me to speak about this, I thought these are important to mention. The Holy Messenger, in one of his testaments to Amirul Mu'mineen, alayhi wasalam, gave a list of do's and don'ts on the eve of his wedding with Lady Fatima, alayhi wasalam. Now, yes, this is for Amirul Mu'mineen, but it applies for us to benefit too. And here he gives a lot of these instructions. Now I'll go through some of them. It's a very long list. I was calculating it. If I was to go through all of them with explanation, it would take two lectures. And since I want to go and speak about all the different phases of child nurturing, it may not be feasible. But I'll go through some of them only so that we wake up to the fact that certain actions that we do at the time of intimacy, it may lead to spiritual side effects in the same way that certain actions that we do in physical terms may lead to physical side effects. Ya Ali, the Holy Messenger said, La tujamir imra'ataka fi awwali shahr wa wasatihi wa akhirihi. فَإِنَّ الْجُنُونَ وَالْجُذَامَ وَالْخَبَلَ لَيُسْرِعُ إِلَيْهَا وَإِلَى وَلَدِهَا. Think, O Amir al-Mu'mineen, at the time when you want to be intimate with your wife, this action, don't commit this action at the beginning of the lunar month or in the middle of the lunar month or at the end of the lunar month. And let me just, one last point I want to mention. In Islam, and this particular action that we want to discuss, one is free. Between man and woman, they can act in whatever way they want. It's permissible to do many things. And in fiqh, we say that. And we'll go through these different actions. All of them are permissible from a fiqhi point of view. But from a tariqa point of view, a batini, esoteric point of view, these are problematic. However, when it comes to conceiving, sometimes you want to commit the act with the intention of conception. Here you have to take immense care. Sometimes, though, you want to commit the act without the intention of conception, and you take the certain measures so conception doesn't result. There, yes, you can take the fiqhi approach and everything is permissible. But when you want to do the act with the intention of conception, you have to take immense care and precaution. I forgot to mention that point, too. So, you shouldn't occupy yourselves with the act at the beginning, middle, and end of the lunar month. Verily, psychosis, skin disease, and insanity with speed will approach and will be encountered by the mother and the child. And you know, with the sisters, postnatal depression is a legitimate concern, and it's not rare. It's a very serious concern. This falls in this category. Once Ayatollah Hassanzada Omri, a parent's man and woman with their child, they came to him for a dua for their child who had epilepsy. And then Ayatollah Hassanzada was asking certain questions. The woman then said that the act, we committed the act at the beginning of the lunar month. Ayatollah Hassanzada said, yes, that woman was very detailed in her calendar of events, her Sharia calendar, which are in relation to the woman, they have to keep certain events in mind. She said the woman was very canonically abiding, that she knew exactly when she did what. And then when she said that to Ayatollah Hassanzada Omri, Ayatollah Hassanzada Omri, in an interview he once gave, he said yes. And he read this tradition. There's a relationship between the stars, the moon, the planets, and us physical beings. We may not have established the link yet, but the relationship is a definite, and we spoke a bit about that last night. So these are important issues. That's the first. Then your Ali, he continues. لَا تُجَامِ إِمْرَعْتَكَ بَعْدَ الظُّهْرِ فَإِنَّهُ إِنْ قُضِيَ بَيْنَكُمَا وَلَدْ فِي ذَلِكَ الْوَقْتِ يَكُونُ أَحْوَلْ وَالشَّيْطَانِ يَفْرَهُ بِالْحَوَلْ فِي الْإِنسَانِ. It's very delicate traditions. It's difficult to digest them. If you don't digest them, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means I haven't been able to explain it properly. Don't panic or don't be disappointed with yourself. In Islam, some truths are difficult. People are of varying degrees of iman. We can't expect everyone to accept everything in maximal terms. That's why we keep on growing towards perfection. Here, don't commit the act with your wife in the afternoon. Afternoon. بعد الظهر. Don't forget, from a fiqh point of view, when you don't want to conceive, it doesn't matter when you occupy yourselves. But when you want to conceive, not afternoon. Why? Because if a child is conceived between the two of you, in this time, the child will be cross-eyed, like a squint. One is cross-eyed physically. And Shaitan is delighted with this cross-eyedness when he sees it in people. This needs explaining. What does this cross-eyedness mean? First of all, in these kind of traditions, first we said it's only potential, it's not a cause and effect, 100% cause and effect relationship, because there are other parameters. We have to see how the parameters blend with one another. Second of all, in epidemiology and statistics, there are two terms of sensitivity and specificity. Just because, for example, in the cross-eyed example, if someone is cross-eyed, they still may not be spiritually cross-eyed, just because they're physically cross-eyed. And just because someone is not physically cross-eyed, it doesn't mean they're not spiritually cross-eyed, just because they're not physically cross-eyed. Why do I even bring the aspect of spiritual cross-eyedness? Because it says Shaitan becomes happy. There's no need for Shaitan to be happy about someone's physical dimensions alone. There has to be a batini, inner dimension here. What's the batini aspect of cross-eyedness, which may or may not lead to that physical cross-eyedness of the child, offspring? Is that when, during the day, for when you go out to work in the bazaar, marketplace, or wherever at the workplace, here you are, if you don't be careful, you're drowned and intoxicated in the worldly life, because you're working and all around you is the dunya, and you give in to the dunya. You become drowned in the dunya. And such a person, with such a status, spiritual status, after being drowned in the dunya as a result of one's work, when they come back home and then commit the act, that has spiritual consequences. Yes, that can be minimized with salat. It can be minimized in the workplace. How you tune your intentions by enforcing muraqabah and self-scrutiny of oneself, and muhasabah, self-accounting, action to action at the work, at the workplace. But let's say you don't do muraqabah, you don't do muhasabah, you become drowned in the worldly life. Then in the afternoon you return with that state, you commit the act for purposes of conception, it leads to at least that spiritual cross-eyedness. And that may or may not have physical manifestations. Ya Ali, another prescription. La tatakallam inda al-jimaa, fa'innahu in qudiya baynakuma walad, la yu'manu an yakuna akhras. When you want to be occupied with the act, don't speak during the act. Because if a child is conceived when you're speaking during the act, not before, during the act. If you speak and a child is conceived, that child may become dumb and can't be able to speak. How are we going to explain that? First of all, it's a potential. And second of all, if you see someone who's dumb, it doesn't mean that their parents did it. Sensitivity and specificity. But in those cases which it is, and we have to take precaution in these steps, what's the relationship here? Well, here, because the act itself, when one is occupied with it, one is totally intoxicated in the dunya during the act. Because the act itself dictates such a state of mind. Especially when one reaches towards the peak, one is totally annihilated in the dunya. Okay? And that's why you have to do a ghusl after it. A wudu on certain parts of the body in a certain way with certain intentions is not sufficient. Because in this act, you become totally annihilated. The whole body has to be ghuslated. Why? Because of this total infatuation with the dunya. So the act itself leads to that state. Now, if you, in addition to that, speak in dunya terms, you've added even more. And that's going to lead to bad consequences. And the tradition says here, one becomes dumb. Unless when you speak, it's not done Allah-lessly. You do it Allah-fully, but that's very difficult. But if you even add to that dunya infatuated state by even speaking in dunya terms, it may lead to that consequence. ولا ينظرن احد الى فرج امراته وليغض بصره عند الجلاء فان النظر الى الفرج يورث العمى في الولد. During the act, you shouldn't see or observe when you have the intention of conception, looking at each other's private parts. Even according to fiqh, it's okay. But with the intention of conception, looking at side effects on the child. The tradition says they become blind. This blindness can be a physical blindness, but it can be a spiritual blindness too. You see, the woman wants to generate a child. The man and the woman, they're generating a child. What they see has an effect, firstly on their souls, and secondly, after conception, on the soul of the conceived. You can't pollute what you see. That's why it's seeing haram things. Why is it haram? Not for just for the sake of seeing it. Because you pollute your soul when you see things. There's a unity between the body and the soul. Hijab, why do we say the women have to cover their hair? It's not for out of security, so that men attack them. That's a sad state of affairs if it arises. That's not the primary reason, it's for the woman herself. She covers the hair, the soul acquires chastity. There's a unity between body and soul. When the body is doing something, it has an effect on the soul, because the body is a manifestation of the soul. Hand to hand, flesh to flesh, contact with a non-mahram is haram. Why? Because when you touch the non-mahram, the soul is being contaminated. But let's say you had gloves and you shook hands, that won't be haram. Or if two pieces of wood touching one another. But flesh to flesh, the soul is being polluted. For men, they also have a hijab. One of the hijab of the men is the beard. Because there are wisdoms. This area is to be covered in the man. For the woman, it's certain areas. For the man, it's other areas. Depending on their biology. So here, there's a unity here. And then what you see with a polluted soul, if you want to conceive, it's going to have polluted side effects.
Salli ala nabi.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Ya Ali, la tujame imra'ataka bi shahwati imra'ati ghayrik. Fa inni akhsha in ghudhiya baynakuma walad ay yakuna مخنثا أو مؤنثا مخبلا. Here, if a man, when he's occupied with the act, he thinks of other than her partner during the act. Here, if a child is conceived, either it will be a male with female attributes, or a female who is psychotic with severe psychological problems. Now here, it's because of what the man was thinking, and that has an effect. Ya Ali, la tujame imrataka min qiyam. فَإِنَّ ذَلِكَ مِنْ فِئْلِ الْحَمِيرِ. I think I'll end with this one, I think. It's the last one, because it gets a bit, after this, it may get a bit graphic after this, I don't really. فَإِنْ قُضِيَ بَيْنَكُمْ وَلَدْ كَوْنَ بَوَالَ. I think we'll I think we'll leave this one. So here, all I wanted to say is that there's a whole list of actions that at the time of the action, it has side effects. So that's for conception. That's for the conception phase. So we've covered preconception and conception. The next phase, 9 months of gestation. This, according to some orafo, is the most important phase of the child's life. And nothing can compensate for it. If you want to be strict and severe in one or two of these phases, this gestation is the place to be with utmost precaution and to be very severe in how you lead your life. 9 months of gestation, according to some scholars, the effects it has on the child is more than the effects of 9 decades in this world. You're shaping those 9 decades in those 9 months. I think some scholars bring some interesting equations. I'm not sure how true it is, but they're very respectable scholars. It's just that sometimes it can be a bit uncomfortable. They say, this is one of those points that it's difficult for the likes of me to digest. They say those 9 months even map the future of those 90 years of the person who is born. Let's say, for example, they give these examples, that during the second month, the woman traveled a lot. During the second decade, that child will travel a lot. Or during the third month, something drastic happened to the woman. During the third decade, it would map onto that child's life, a drastic event. They go even that far. But without a doubt, 9 months of gestation is the most important phase, and the major onus lies with the mother directly, but also the father indirectly, because the gestation is happening in the womb of the mother. What should the woman do? What should the man do during these 9 months? What the man and the husband, because his role is limited directly, but indirectly he has a big role in many ways. First of all, look, what starts as a unicellular embryo of one cell, an embryo has only one cell, after 9 months becomes 3.5 or 4 kilograms. 3.5 kilograms. I know you work in ounces here. This is the mother generating that embryo. And the mother's thoughts, the mother's actions, the mother's intentions, the mother's feelings are feeding this embryo. She's giving her existence to this child. After conception itself, the male generates by seminal emission. The woman generates for 9 months though. The man's role is limited. But for 9 months, the woman is still generating the child. She's generating. Her soul is generating. She's giving her soul, her body to this child. How she thinks has an effect on the child. Her actions have an effect on the child. Her intentions have an effect on the child. Her getting angry has an effect on the child. her sadness has an effect on the child. So here, the husband, his role is to provide a very tranquil, relaxed 9 months for the mother. That's what she can do. Even if the husband isn't that type of a person who can offer such services to the woman, and men are different in different ways, but these 9 months he has to do a jihad. He shouldn't do things that can aggravate or precipitate the woman's anger or sadness or depression and so on and so forth. He has to maximally provide everything so that those 9 months the woman is in utter calm and tranquility. It's important. These house chores especially, if he can bring someone to help so that she doesn't tire herself, she doesn't burden herself, these have an effect. Now, I know this is ideal, and no one can do this 100%. I didn't do it 100%, you may not. But everyone to the best of their capacity. No one is expecting miracles or wonders or everything. But here the man and wife have to speak with one another. The woman has to share her feelings to the husband during this time. This makes me sad. This gets me angry. Don't do this. Tell this to your husband. And the husband has to make an effort to comply. And then even when she eats, she should eat very simple foods. And she should eat slowly, in small morsels. She should try to tame her animal dimension. Animals eat fast. Animals eat in large morsels. When she wants to sleep, eat and do other things, she has to do it in the least animalistic way possible. A tamed animal soul will lead to positive effects on the child's soul. But an animalistic soul will lead to negative side effects. The woman shouldn't preoccupy her mind with many things. I'll give examples here. My examples may not be legitimate. Don't worry about the examples I give. You may think of better examples. I'm just giving you the general principles. Here the principle is she shouldn't mentally preoccupy herself excessively. For example, she shouldn't watch too much television. Because all those images, she's now constructing mental images. Well, her images, what she sees, has an effect on the soul. She's generating a child within. Whatever she sees is going to have an effect on the child. Don't underestimate this principle that the Urafa have given. Ayatullah Hassan Zolli stresses this. These discussions I'm giving can be found in one of his books, which is written in relation to Lady Fatima alayhi wasalam. And there it goes into detail, and he brings the works of Ibn Sina and the earlier scholars and how they showed it, and he brings traditions and so on and so forth. Don't underestimate it. Even the colors you see has an effect. Some colors you shouldn't see more. I don't want to go into too much detail, because I feel like many may then become obsessed. But television, don't overdo it. Socializing, don't listen to any rubbish that people speak about. This ear, don't pollute it. It'll pollute the child during gestation. Don't socialize. Or if you want to socialize, a minimum. If the woman wants to stay at home, the man shouldn't insist for them to go out to a party. Or even if it's coming to the masjid and the woman doesn't feel comfortable for whatever reason. But if you want to go out and socialize, a minimum, don't overdo things. this mental preoccupation has side effects. One of the wisdoms why a woman can't have two husbands or more is because imagine a woman who is generating a child during gestation and she has two husbands. She's mentally preoccupying herself with two men, and that has a raping effect on the child. It's spiritually on a par with child rape. And these are delicate issues that Islam has. Yes, maybe the Imam mentioned that if you pour water from four glasses, then you want to put the water back, you can't. Well, that's for people of that time, that example was given. Someone may come with the dilemma and question that, well, the DNA now. That's not the point. The point is spiritual contamination of the woman, especially when gestating, during gestation. Some women disclose abnormal behavior. And actually, they may be religious women. What do I mean by that? That during the 9 months, they overdo reading the Quran and du'as. Now, if they used to do it before, and they're just continuing, that's okay. But if they're just doing it for these 9 months, that may be a state of spiritual nifaq and hypocrisy. It's possible. And that may have an effect, a negative effect. The child may be a hypocrite, may be a munafiq. In the revolution in Iran, we had many parents who were very religious. The child ended up as a hypocrite. Now, I'm not saying this happened to them. I'm just saying it's possible. They should act as they usually act. This going over the top by reading the Quran, well, they don't really feel like reading, but they keep on doing it because of the child, don't think that has good effects. It may have negative, and especially when you're burdening yourself, it doesn't have good effects here. This is not normal behavior. You have to be a comprehensive figure and live safely in all your dimensions. You shouldn't act unidimensionally and do ifrat and excess in one area during those 9 months. You have to live moderately during those 9 months. We want a moderate child to be born. But no one denies the effects of the Quran on the child if you're reading it. But you have to bear in mind this aspect too. Okay, so I think with gestation, we'll stop here. And there are many things one can say, but we will stop here. Next is, and this is very quickly, this next phase, that of delivery. Now the child has been delivered. During labor, there are du'as to be read. I can't say anything more than that. But once the child is delivered, one of the most significant protocols that Sharia-abiding people abide by this and they pay attention to this is after delivery, during the first few days after delivery, they consume dates, rotab. And this is based on the Holy Quran, chapter 19, verse number 25. Wahuzzi, and shake, O Maryam, in relation to Lady Maryam, alayhi wasalam. Wahuzzi ilayki bijidh'i nakhla. Shake the trunk of the palm tree towards yourself. Shake it. Tusaqit alayki rutaban janiyya. And then fresh, ripe dates will fall. Because of that, there must be wisdoms behind it. here, I won't say always, but especially for the first week, during the postpartum period, yes, I think consuming dates is good. We have it in the traditions, and the traditions speak of having it 7 at a time. If that's too much, okay, have it once at a time, doesn't matter. But 7 dates have been prescribed by the imams, and then the effects on the child, things like this has come. Illa kana haliman wa kanat halimatan. If someone does this, the result is but that they become halim or halima if they're female. They acquire a sense of forbearance as a child and when they grow up. Hilm. Or yakhruj awladukum hukama. They acquire wisdom. And maybe the life of Nabi Isa, we see these two traits a lot. But anyway, dates have this effect. And in delivery, this prescription is one of the significant ones. Also, there are certain du'as, but I don't know of any particular specific prescriptions other than the issue of dates. Okay. Then we come when the child is born. When the child is born, now we have a lot of prescriptions. What to do and when to do it. Here the first is reading the adhan and the iqame in the right and left ears of the child. Doesn't matter if the child is male or female. Now there's some differences among scholars. It's not a big issue, don't worry about it. Whether you should do it after the child actually screams or after the cord is clamped, I don't think that's something we should look into too much, in too much detail, because these things, it leads to a kind of agitation and stress. I mean, the timing is already stressful. And when one wants to relate particular, they can acquire waswas if they want to do everything by the book. Some things, it doesn't matter which way you do it. But here, what's the issue with the adhan and the iqama? Well, these are the slogans of our religion. These are the main principles of our religion. Tawheed, Nubuwwah, Salat, and so on and so forth. And here, the first words you want the child to hear are these words. It has an effect. Okay, it may be rudimentary, maybe basic, but it has an effect on the soul. The first thing that the child hears, there's a unity between body and soul, the soul will elevate to some degree, even though it's on a par with that of a newborn. But you're doing the service for the soul of the child. Remember that the baggage which the child brings with it because of the actions of the ancestors, this can lessen that baggage. See, we want to minimize that baggage which the child acquired at birth. The next thing after adhan and iqama, I'm trying to say it in the order that it has to be done, is doing the ghusl. A minority of scholars have said by ghusl is just a basic washing, not the sharia ghusl. But the majority have said no, it's the sharia ghusl. So do the sharia ghusl. Now the midwife may not be a Muslim. Doesn't matter. You can tell her teacher to do it. Now sometimes it's harmful to do the ghusl to a newborn. It doesn't matter, you can delay it by 2 or 3 days. If it's still harmful, you don't do it. It's okay. There's no problem in not doing it. And so that's another prescription that is given. And you know, the wudu and the ghusl, these are physical actions. But each one has inner, botany meanings. And the person doing the us, they have to know what these meanings are. And unfortunately, we've only taken the superficial aspect of these divine rituals. But these divine rituals are multidimensional. And you won't grow through these divine rituals if you only suffice with doing the superficial. You can do the wudu 80 years of your life and you're still not growing, and you question, why not? But you only suffice with the physical washing and wiping. You never took into consideration with each limb how you should be thinking. You only looked at the physical side, and then your child would say, well, I've just had a shower, I'm much more cleaner physically. Why should I do the wudu again? Oh. How are you going to answer now? When your wudu was spiritless all your life, what have you to answer to the child? The child's right here. It's a rational question. Next is wiping very gently, very quickly with your finger the upper palate of the child. But don't stick your hand there and keep your hand there and rub all. No, no, no. But it's important that the touch is made. This is a form of insha generation. With what? With one or two specks of the turba of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. With a drop of Zamzam water if you have it. With the water of the Euphrates if you have it. If you don't have it, rain water. If that's not possible, warm water. And the intention is that you want your child to make that quest towards justice and truth. And with your finger, you make that contact with that intention. It's a kind of insha. It may not have an effect, it may have an effect, depending on your sincerity. But this also has been prescribed. Here is as if the first taste that the child is doing is via this action. The first hearing was via that action. The first touch was, well, in the womb. That doesn't really apply. The first seeing, who do they see? They see the believing mother or father reciting. And the first smell, well, the smell faculty isn't working as strong, and that's why maybe Islam hasn't brought any prescriptions in this particular regard, maybe. Okay, just looking at the time, I just want to finish with the opening this phase, so that we can then start with the breastfeeding phase tomorrow. I'll try to do it quickly. On the seventh day, three things have to be done. Shaving of the hair of the child, and its worth in silver or gold, you give it to the fuqara. On the seventh day. If you delay it, there's no need to then do it. You can if you want. But the effect is on the seventh day. Another thing on the seventh day is slaughtering a sheep. If it's a female, slaughter a female sheep. These are all emphatically recommended actions. This is the aghire. These are elements of the aghire here. This aghire, some of the fuqaha of old said it was wajib. Today everyone says it's recommended, but emphatically recommended. When things are emphatically recommended, pay heed to them. We don't have many of them. It's much more worthy and valuable than mere mustahab actions. On the seventh day, you slaughter a sheep. If it's a female child, female sheep. If it's a male child, a male sheep. I'll come to this slaughtering in a minute, who do you give the meat to? There are a lot of prescriptions here. But another thing, on the seventh day also, you give the name of the child, on the seventh day. Before the seventh day, if it's male, you can, and it's recommended to call them Muhammad. If on the seventh day you want to keep the name, keep the name. If you want to change the name, it's unproblematic, it's okay. Even in the womb, it's recommended to give a name. And if you don't know if it's male or female, give a unisex name. But if you know, you can even give a name and call them by that name. We do have that also in the traditions. But on the seventh day, now you want to give a name. You have to choose a good name, a decent name, a name of the prophets, a name of the imams, a name which expresses ubudiyya and servitude, like Abdullah, Abdul Rahman, Abdul Samad, rather than giving Allah's names like Rahman. It's better not to call them Rahman or Rahim or Samad. Abdul Rahman, Abdul Rahim, Abdul Samad. Some fuqaha of old even said it's haram to call them Rahman or Rahim. But today no one says that. Okay, and that is in relation to the name. So that's on the seventh day you give the name. With the aqiqah, the question is, who do you give the meat to? First of all, if on the seventh day you don't give the aqiqah, in contrast to the shaving of the hair, even if it's delayed, you do it. Even if it's delayed by many years, you still do it. The effects of that is very important. So the aqiqah, that by it becoming delayed, you still do it. The effects don't go altogether. Even for example, if someone has a child who is 7 and they didn't do the aqiqah, it's even recommended when they reach puberty, do the aqiqah. We do have these traditions. But who do you give the meat to? Here, we have a lot of traditions here. And some of them are very specific. First, you give it to the believers and you ask them to pray for your child. So, once you slaughter the meat, that raw meat, you then give it to certain believers and then you ask them to pray for your child. That's one way. A better way is for you to cook it, invite at least 10 believers and give them the food and ask them to pray for the child. But the direct family members of that child, they shouldn't consume from the meat. They should give it to other than the family. Something remarkable though, that we may not know or practice, is that when you slaughter the sheep, a quarter of it, or one leg of it, you give to the midwife. Even if they're Christian, it doesn't matter. You tell them our religion, our culture dictates such that we give a quarter of the slaughtered animal to you and you give it to them. Okay, there are one or two other issues with the shaving of the hair. It's also symbolic of the slaughtering of the soul. And then there are other issues too in relation to circumcision. With your permission, I think I've passed the time. We'll continue with this inshallah tomorrow. Wa sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.